Welcome back to Cairo Nights. I mentioned this earlier in the show tonight about how interested I am on the effect of social media. And I think I have probably more times than you listeners want to hear, I have touted the Social Dilemma documentary as being a really great explainer on how these things are affecting us and how intentional that effect actually is. Joining us right now is Asa Raskin. He is the co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology. The Center for Humane Technology is mentioned quite a bit in the documentary. Asa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let me start off first off with what does the Center for Humane Technology do? And then let's talk about it in reference to a lot of the issues brought up in the Social Dilemma. What does the Center for Humane Technology do, you as co-founder?
The Center for Humane Technology, we started as a set of technology insiders that have been up and close, whether it's in Google or Mozilla or these other companies, understanding exactly how technology is built and to keep you using a product rather than necessarily to help you using the product. And we were standing up and saying, hey, this isn't this technology is no longer serving humans. It's, in fact, starting to degrade the way that we talk to each other, the way we see the world, our relationships, our mental health, and something needs to change.
And so let's talk now about the movie, which the documentary, which was, I think, a really interesting expose on the things that we see maybe in our social media as inadvertent. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about how social media affects folks from a depression standpoint or from, the way the like button is essentially a dopamine doser, those sort of things. But talk a little bit more about the deliberate nature. Like in the documentary, it talks about with the gentleman who invented the like button, or at least was a co-inventor of the like button. Tell me about what social media, in your mind, what is social media trying to do for us other than allow us to get in touch with an old girlfriend or a high school teammate?
The first thing I think that's really important to remember is that when we call them social media, social sites, or apps, it actually hides their true nature. These things are immense digital habitats that we're now living, with COVID, half or more of our waking lives. And the shape of the environments that we live in deeply affect who we are, how we value ourselves, how we communicate with each other. So, the most important question to ask when you're dealing with any kind of large-scale system or AI system, as is the recommendation engines inside of Facebook and Twitter and TikTok, are, what are we wishing for? What are we asking the machines to optimize us for? And the answer is, because all these companies are fighting for a finite resource, which is our attention, they are training smarter and smarter supercomputers to figure out our particular vulnerabilities so they can harvest our attention and then sort of sell it for advertisers. And this has a whole bunch of terrible downstream effects. So to give one example, it turns out the thing that gets people coming back is outrage, is anger. And so what Facebook does is it ends up showing you all the people you agree with most, that's a filter bubble, and then all of the people from the other side, as far away from you as possible, the ones that really push your button, and they're constantly putting these two groups together. And this means that we're getting increased amounts of, one, people you agree with right next to people that you hate the most, and that creates a whole bunch of engagement, a whole bunch of profits, sort of hate for profit, at the same time as it destroys our ability to agree on such a thing as fact to begin with. And when you can't agree on fact, you can't have democracy, and humanity can't rise to meet the challenges of the 21st century, because all of our biggest problems, things like climate change and racial inequality, are problems that we have to come together to solve.
Well, it occurred to me when I was watching the Social Dilemma documentary and thinking about the Center for Humane Technology, it occurred to me that I think what I was learning from it is that the idea in social media, and we always think of this as as inadvertent and not an intent. I think the documentary explains that this is actually an intent, that it builds, it doesn't build serenity in your head. It's building a weather system, kind of a violent weather system in your head. Is that a fair way of describing it?
Yeah, I think that is. And it's not like anyone at these companies set out to try to make people distracted and polarized and hateful or depressed. It's just that those happen to be very effective ways of grabbing engagement and grabbing your time. So I think it was really instructive to follow the course of this. You know, up until 2018, Facebook was optimized for time spent. How much time were you spend on their site? But in 2018, a campaign that Center for Humane Technology started, the Time Well Spent movement, forced Facebook to change what they were optimizing for. And they went from optimizing time spent to meaningful social interaction. But of course, what is a meaningful social interaction? How do they measure it? It turns out they just measured it based on reactivity. That is, when you post something, that post will get more engagement. It'll get more amplified based on how much your friends react to it. Another way of saying that is, it's how reactive your content is, how quickly it spreads, how viral it goes. And when that happens, you can see it creates the condition for a kind of social climate crisis. Just like the real climate crisis, the physical climate crisis creates the conditions in which wildfires spread through California like nothing. It's creating the conditions in which people are more prone to conspiracy, to reactivity, to outrage. It creates that, as you say, this sort of like cyclone in people's minds where it's hard to know what's real and what's not real.
Well, then let me talk a little bit about an idea that it's kind of been building in my head, something I think I had wrong, and maybe I am getting closer to getting somewhere nearer to right on this, or at least I can ask, how do I get to being correct on this? So I, for a long time, what I've argued about social media, I try to really limit my interaction. I have to do some of it, obviously, professionally here on the radio and as a newspaper reporter prior to that. But I have always argued that the one thing I didn't like about Facebook, one of the many things I didn't like about Facebook, for example, is that it didn't give me the privilege of ignorance about some of my, say, like family members or relatives and people like that, that I don't need to know these things. I liked them more before I did. And I think that there's probably people who feel the same way, obviously, about me. But then it occurred to me when I was watching the documentary that maybe they weren't this. Maybe they didn't feel as much like this prior, that I hadn't considered the effect that they have been as much changed by the environment as my perception of them has changed. Does that make sense? And is that something you can talk about a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the polarization we see today, I think, is because we've been put under this artificial spell for the last 10 years. Imagine that you put on a pair of glasses 10 years ago, and that pair of glasses just shows you all the things that really annoy you about whatever you're looking at. So, you know, you're at home, and you just see where the toilet seat's been left up. You see where, like, your son or your daughter left all the dishes out. It's just showing you the things that you hate and annoy you the most. Well, that's exactly what Facebook is like, and that's exactly what Twitter is like. It's this pair of glasses that shows you the worst of everybody else for you. And of course, if you're living in those glasses, you're going to feel that the world is out to get you in a terrible place. And I think the big hope of the film, and we're actually starting to see responses, is that it lets people take the glasses off for a little bit and be like, wait, this isn't us. I think one of the biggest sort of like foibles, like the wool being pulled over our eyes that the tech companies have done, is that they've convinced us that when we look into screens, that we are looking into mirrors. But we're not looking into a mirror. We're not really seeing our true selves. We're not really seeing society. We're seeing a funhouse distorted mirror, and it's even worse than that. It's a funhouse distorted mirror that's a one-way mirror where there's a camera on the other side watching everything we do and using all of our reactions to target us even more. And I think the hope for the film is that if we can all see this at the same time and realize that this is an illusion and that we all agree more than we think, then we can sort of take a breath and start moving forward again.
We're talking with Asa Ruskin, the co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology. And we're also talking in a broad way about the movie, the documentary, rather, The Social Dilemma, and how we don't understand how social media, as we change it, it changes us. And as we engage in it, it changes actually the way we think about things. Asa, so how does somebody manage to handle social media in some form that can be more constructive than destructive? I know that everyone always talks about just taking a break from it or turning it off, and there's things about it, I would guess, given that you have a history of working with this sort of technology. Certainly everyone at the Center for Humane Technology has a history of working with this. What are the assets we really want to keep, and what is the stuff that we can filter out and not keep and maybe become a little bit less reactive than we have become?
It's a great question. And I think that the first thing for people to note is that even if you don't use social media, you still live in a world that does. So the true solution to this problem isn't going to be an individual solution. It needs to be something that we are asking as a society, demanding for regulation and protection. We have not yet ever even tried to regulate the attention economy or the surveillance economy, and that should give us a lot of hope because we haven't even tried. Now, that said, there are things that we can do individually, but it's sort of like being in a pandemic. There are things you can do individually to make you, like, a little safer, but we still live in a pandemic. You still might get right. caught up into it. So one thing I think that's great to do is understand the mechanics of what's going on behind the screen. Because it's really easy to look at your Facebook feed or your TikTok feed and see cute cats and people dancing and just think that's all there is to it. But behind the scenes, on the other side of that screen, are 1,000 engineers that are using advanced A/B testing to understand your particular psychology and weaponize against that, essentially exploiting your own behavior for profit. So understanding those mechanics are key. Like, one simple example is to ask yourself, like, oh, I wonder why they did that. When Facebook discovered that they could send an email that said, like, a friend of yours has tagged you in a photo, don't you want to see it? It turned out that was incredibly valuable for Facebook. They dialed the hell out of that because people would come back. And the question to ask yourself is, of course, why didn't they include the photo in the email? That's because they were exploiting
exactly.
a vulnerability, your behavior, knowing that you want to see what you look like. That's vanity, to get you to do what they want. And once you're on the site, of course, you started to scroll a whole bunch. So I think that's important. So, like, watch the film, watch it with friends so you can discuss it. Turn off then notifications from anything that's not a human. Delete the apps that are no longer serving you. And then pause whenever you feel online like something is trying to push your buttons. When you feel that anger come up, really pause, because it's probably intentional.
Yeah, that's a really, really, really good point. So how do we know? I mean, I know that one of the ways, and I really liked what you had to say about understanding what's behind the screen. I know that, you know, if a kid gets scared about something, you know, it's a ghost movie or something in the house, the way you sort of dissipate that fear is you show them, well, no, this is a puppet. It's a device. It's something that is not actually, it's not the sum total of what your fear actually is. And that understanding why you're getting triggered by this video of a confrontation in a Walmart, or why you're getting triggered by this political statement by somebody you disagree with strongly, how that stuff starts iterating on itself. But talk to me for a real minute about, I love the thing about the, because I definitely have succumbed to this. A friend just posted a picture of you, or you've been tagged in a photo, all those sort of things, those alerts that send you down the rabbit hole again. Are they sophisticated enough that it's not just a friend on Facebook, but maybe it's somebody you've had a particular form of interaction with? Or is it simply just, hey, this person's in their contact list? I mean, how does that algorithm work, or do we know?
Well, of course, the scariest thing is we don't actually know, because it's sort of like, you know, there's a crime scene, or perhaps even it's a better way to say it this way. It's like, it's as if Exxon Mobil was the only company that had the satellite data to know about global warming and climate change.
Right.
Right. It's like they're the only ones with the data. So how do we trust them? So we know, though, that the way that they target messages can be very, very accurate. And one way to see that for yourself is look at the people you may know feature in Facebook. And that thing is scarily accurate, right?
Right,
it's like often
true.
You'll hung out with someone, you haven't tagged them in a photo, and somehow Facebook knows. So if they can do that with that kind of granular, like surgical precision for that feature, you know that it's being used all over the place. And often, it's not that Facebook or TikTok or Reddit know and are using this intentionally. It's not like some like an engineer has walked through and looked for these correlations. It's much worse than that. It's that there's sort of an amoral AI is just crunching through data, finding correlations, and then pounding them to exploit it. An example of this was I think it was in 2016, Facebook or one of their internal sales pitches said that, you know, teenage women that were depressed were more likely to buy cosmetics, and hence that was a great target market. And you're like, wait, hold on for a second.
Wow.
That means you're
exploiting
people with an insecurity, right? And the real point is that because this is happening at scale, automated, 6 trillion decisions made per day, that no one is looking over the shoulder and understanding all of those kinds of finding the soft animal underbelly of the human mind and exploiting them.
Right, right. We are talking with Asa Raskin, the co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology, and we're talking about the documentary Social Dilemma and how social media is affecting us intentionally in ways that we don't understand. Okay, final question, although I could go on with you for hours on this because it's so interesting to me. When we're looking at the effect of social media, and when I hear you talk about the what is intentionally designed, the notion of selling cosmetics based on could be depressive teenage girls or girls who are feeling that way because of social media, what sort of pass do we give the companies that are designing this? Because right now it seems like most of the discussion regarding a Facebook or a social media is much more sort of antitrust. Do they own too much of X market? But not really about the social cost. I don't know that there is law that can exist, does exist, or should exist regarding how they affect us in this sort of way. We see all these correlations and sometimes causations in studies, but then what do we do at that point?
Yeah. Well, so we have to start binding the scale of impact with the liability for that impact. I think a good analogy here is the climate crisis, which is we took capitalism, we pointed the engines of capitalism at the finite resources of Earth, extracting those, polluted the environment, which is causing, the wildfires here, it's causing sea level rises, causing giant hurricanes. That very same pattern is happening now from these companies, except instead of the Earth being mined, it's us being mined for our finite resource, which is our attention and our decisions.
And our happiness.
And in the process of extracting us, all that from us, it pollutes our information environment so that we don't know what's real and what's not real. And that creates the hurricanes and the wildfires, creating the social climate change.
Wow. That is Asa Raskin, the co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology. Asa, thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights. And you made the mistake of giving me your phone number, so I am going to be bugging you from time to time. But I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking to us about this, because the good news, I guess, for the Center for Humane Technology is this stuff isn't going anywhere anytime soon. And so it is something worth spending a lot of time paying attention to and certainly trying to understand at a deeper level. So we appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so very much, Mike.
No need to ask, he's a smooth operator.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. Boeing is front and center in the news. One story that is yet to be confirmed and another one that absolutely is. Joining us, of course, is Chris Sullivan, Cairo's own Boeing expert. Chris, what is the biggest story today on Boeing, 737 or 787?
Well, I would say probably the 3-7, only because if the Wall Street Journal is right about the 8-7, it's something that we had all anticipated expected, unfortunately, and we'll get to that in a minute. But yeah, I think it's a big deal that the head of the FAA actually flew the MAX today for a 2-hour flight over to Moses Lake and back and tested out the MCAS system and put the plane through its, you know, through all of its paces and felt pretty good about it coming out of that. I think that's a very big milestone, if not for the psyche of the program, if there is such a thing, but for the people who, you know, want to feel good about getting in that plane again sometime, that the head of the FAA made a promise that he said he wouldn't certify it till he felt safe and would fly his family on it, and he flew it today and he feels pretty good about it. So that's a big jump.
And did he actually say anything about the flight itself, or was he just pretty, yeah, seems to be working fine, feels like a 737?
Yeah, from what I understand, kind of generalities, right. Didn't talk specifics about, you know, stick shakers or alarms or things like that, or, you know, angle of attack sensors. And, you know, but it's possible. I didn't see the whole of press conference after, but it seems like, you know, he just kind of spoke in generalities, like, hey, I feel good about this, but this is not the last step in this process before we, you know, move forward towards certification. This is just one more check, something that isn't actually technically part of the recertification process. It's just something he felt he needed to do as the head of the FAA to kind of put his, you know, his money where his mouth is on this, that if they're going to recert this plane, that he's going to know it intimately. And I think he made good on that today.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of interesting. Oftentimes you don't see the head of an agency all that familiar with the product they are regulating and one who can actually get in and legally fly, be a commercial airline pilot and fly something, I think is a little bit encouraging. But do you think there's something else going on here, too? Remember, two giant organizations lost enormous credibility worldwide, Boeing and the FAA itself, in this whole process. Do you think he's also trying to send a message to the other regulatory bodies in other countries that, hey, I'm willing to get in this plane, you can find the FAA credible again?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And I think that's kind of what I was getting at in talking about the psyche of it, or the public acceptance, the other regulators, the rest of the world, seeing someone, you know, in this high of a rank to get in and actually fly the plane. I think the optics of that is something that needed to be done to show the rest of the world whatever it is they need to feel comfortable about getting in this plane again once it is recertified. So, yeah, I think that's definitely, I mean, I wouldn't call it a full PR move, but it was certainly something that helps in the intangibles category,
right,
when getting the public and the other, you know, the regulators around the world comfortable again about getting this plane back into service and putting their passengers, their countrymen and women, back into a plane that you know, went down twice and killed more than 300, you know, people. I mean, I don't think that you can put a higher point on that to show, okay, if it's safe, well, oh yeah, I flew it. That's how much I believe in this plane.
Right. And so do we know what's next then for the recertification process?
Well, there are a bunch of different flight tests and a bunch of different things that need to go on. The regulators need to, you know, do flight testing in the simulators as well. I think a few others also plan on flying the plane as well before they recertify it. I think Canada is doing that.
Right.
Brazil might be as well. So there are some other things that have to happen, a lot of dotting of I's and crossing of T's as we move forward. But if it goes well, I mean, they're talking, what, November-ish, I think, of when they might recertify it, which means passengers could get back on this plane before the end of the year. But again, we'll see what the demand is. People can check these days of what kind of plane they're going to be flying, and we'll see how people feel about getting on this plane again.
Well, yeah, exactly. As someone with the airline industry said, they're going to give people the option of opting out, and they expect Boeing to cover up, to help compensate them for the losses based on people opting out, at least initially, of 737s. But remember, they opted out of MD-80s for a while and ultimately came back around on that, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unheard of, you know, for that to happen. And let's face it, there are enough 737s out there that aren't right. the MAX variety that is a fabulous airplane, you know, the most popular in the world. It's just whether or not you can get enough of those around to meet the demand with however many MAXs were supposed to be in service.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that's something that you have to do. Give people the option. I know when I got on a plane, or last time I did was earlier this year, but you always look and I feel good about padding the Renton placard that's right there as you go through the door. I look up there and I go, oh, it's an 800. Oh, nice. Very good. Pat on that. Go good. I know the people who work at the Renton plant. It's a good plane.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'll do that the first time I get on a MAX. I'll probably be a little hesitant, but I mean, if they do what they're supposed to do in the training, the pilots get the training they need. I don't think there's any reason why we can't go forward and once again have confidence in this plane.
I think so. I think so as well. All right, Sully, on to now. And the one thing that also made this more important news is this could be the only Boeing aircraft that, other than maybe some cargo stuff, that we are manufacturing here, or commercial aircraft that we are manufacturing here as a result of the bad news, at least the bad news for the area. Maybe this is actually not bad news for Boeing, but it's unconfirmed. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal basically came out this morning and said, or last night, said what we have all been anticipating, that Boeing will be moving the 787 production line in Everett and consolidating it in the plant in North Charleston, South Carolina. It's something that we've been hearing about all summer long, basically since the second quarter earnings report came out, where the company was talking about this because they're bleeding money and there's no demand right now for these twin aisle planes to consolidate the lines as a money-making feature. And by all standards, everybody who looked at this objectively realized that North Charleston in South Carolina was the appropriate choice for Boeing if you're looking at dollars and cents. It just made sense to them from a financial standpoint. But it's a huge blow to lose the 787 production line if that's in fact what will happen in Everett. I mean, it's about 1,000 employees. I mean, there are 30,000 employees at the plant up here in Snohomish County, but you know, 1,000 more job losses on top of 12,000 or so already because of the pandemic and the downturn this year in Washington State. It's another blow.
Yeah, and a blow also in prestige. I mean, the first one was when, of course, Boeing moved its headquarters to Chicago. But having the 787, which was Boeing's newest, best, most advanced aircraft here, I think was a point of pride. Did they address this idea about mistake level in South Carolina as opposed to mistake level here? Because that's also been, and the Wall Street Journal has covered that pretty extensively as well.
Yeah, and there is a full-on FAA investigation into the production practices at the plant in South Carolina. And we've heard for years, and we've talked about this before, Mike, from workers at the Boeing plant in Everett who said how much rework they have to do from parts of the plane that get flown to Everett from South right. Carolina for final assembly. And that, you know, there's been a big learning curve for people. I mean, building an airplane is not like putting together a lawnmower or a car. It's a different animal. And yes, that's a big concern, but whether or not that rose to the level that Boeing thinks it has it handled, that may not have been a big enough factor over the dollars and cents to consolidate the lines. But yeah, they've got a production issue so much so that they're looking at what? 893 of the planes that have ever been built, and there've been less than 1,000.
Right,
I mean, almost 90% of the planes they're looking at to see because of the touch of South Carolina to make sure that they're all good.
Right, exactly, true. So is there anything that can happen in your mind that can happen between now and X to keep the production here? I know the governor has weighed in on it and now has done a kind of a tacit, mild threat about Boeing's tax breaks, and maybe we need to relook at those. Obviously, the union here is fighting as well. I mean, what can actually happen at this point, or do you think this is a done deal?
Well, I mean, I don't know what else you can do to tell a private company that they can't do what it is they want to do for their own financial best interests, right?
Right.
And so the one thing you can hope is that the economy, the international passenger flight economy, comes back to the point over the next couple of years that Boeing will need to start cranking out more 787s a month than they plan on, the five or six they plan on doing now going forward based on the current market demand. If they
right.
need to get back up to 14 or 15 planes a month, then maybe they will have cause to reopen the line here in Everett. Or maybe they have enough room down in South Carolina to make 14 a month. I don't know that. But I don't see anything on in the short term that we as a state or lawmakers here can do to make Boeing change its mind on this, because it's a financial decision. It's not a, they're not out to get the union. They're not out to screw employees. It is, they are bleeding cash right now, and they're trying to save money wherever they can. That plan is more automated than and less worker intensive. Of course, the non-union down there, plus they don't have to fly the Dreamlifter back and forth to bring parts and fuselage sections for the Dash 10 to Everett for final assembly. So I don't know what can be done. This appears to be a fait accompli.
That is Chris Sullivan, Cairo's own. Chris, thank you very much for getting back with us on Boeing. And I guess we'll see what the next turn of the screw is next time we talk about Boeing, which will probably be sooner than later.
Yeah, well, the earnings report comes out, here in about 3 weeks. So, yeah, that'll be very interesting as well.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chris.
Anytime, Mike.
Coming up, of course, a random question robot. And then at the top of the hour, Stacey Joe will be talking about, for some weird reason, the Cincinnati Reds, but also just about the baseball playoffs and the Dolphins, who the Seahawks face next weekend, right after the break. Welcome back to the show. Time again for us to be, everyone gets a little nervous before this. I mean, there's a little pacing around. There's some sweating. People are worried that the Questrotron 700 is once again gunning for us.
It's always
gunning. It's only because it is. But we don't have a choice. We don't sign the paychecks. We don't make the decisions.
That's right.
Other entities do.
Out of our hands.
All right, Frank, you're going to get the first one.
Okay.
Name, but you have to pick one or the other. Name and describe your best or your worst vacation.
Best vacation, Bryce Canyon, completely by myself, first discovery of it. Second runner-up, first runner-up, Yellowstone, same thing.
All right. That works in Yellowstone, just because I've been to Yellowstone. It's spectacular.
Yeah, and the first time you go around a corner and there's a geyser, it's like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's real.
It's real. It's not just cartoons, yeah. Right? Exactly. All right, Shane?
One of my good buddies, for our senior year, his parents decided to buy us a condo in Maui down the street from the Grand Wailea Hotel.
Wow.
Weeks after we graduated.
Wow.
Yeah, my buddy's parents were extremely generous.
Loaded.
Outrageously generous.
The word that comes to mind.
Yeah, that's
stinking,
you might be
rich.
Better, yeah, that might be a better word. But they literally were like, well, hey, Shane, like, I know you just graduated. You want to come with? So I had like an all-expenses-paid trip to Maui when I graduated high school.
God. Wow. So we're going with bests here. I'm going to give you both, but I'm going to give you both because it happened in the same vacation on the first day. So no offense to my I went on a great vacation to Turkey a few years ago. I don't know that was the best. I also went on a vacation to Morocco and a few other things that were wonderful, but this one has elements of best and worst. This is why I'm using it. So first day in Turkey, I managed to lose in Istanbul, because I've been up for about 30 hours by the time we got there. I managed to lose my passport within 3 hours of being in Istanbul at the very beginning of a vacation. This means you can't, and we're on the cusp of Ramadan. So everything is closed. The U.S. Embassy is going to close for 2 weeks in hours for it before I can get a new passport. I end up in this mad scramble for hours trying to get through. I finally get through to somebody in the embassy. They say that I've got to get up there 70 kilometers away, since 9/11 is no longer in actual Istanbul. The embassy is. And then out of the blue, I have the desk called the police department, which I had called several times, but I couldn't speak Turkish, so I couldn't get through. And it turns out that someone had found my passport in Istanbul, turned it into the police station 5 hours after I lost it in the Blue Mosque.
Wow.
There you go.
Wow.
So that immediately augured from worst
to best.
To best. In that very,
absolutely,
very moment.
I'd say
wow, getting your passport back in Istanbul is an unusual. That's a lottery ticket day.
Yes, it is.
Name a time that you were so wrong about something you will never forget it, Shane.
Oh, God. You know what? I can't really think of one. I'm usually pretty right. I mean, I'm going to be honest. So, I'm a pretty smart guy. So, I like to talk a lot.
So here it is. That was it right now, folks. You just got to hear him be wrong in a way he will never, ever forget. Frank.
I don't know if you guys remember this, but it would be a year. Was it last year or the year before?
Gardner Minshew.
Yeah.
Right? Perfect. Wonderful season.
Right.
Comes down to the Apple Cup. The one year that it looks like they can kick their butts. I'm saying, yeah, it's going to happen. Snow. Okay. And what happens? The Cougs get bulldozed.
They
Cougs. Oh, don't say that.
Don't
That's
say that.
Hated. I
but,
hate that.
But see, but then, but you're wrong about that a lot, Frank.
Every year.
I don't know if that actually applies. All right. So mine is... in the Modesto B newsroom, I remember two things I loudly declared, both within, I don't know. Well, one was just before I just became a reporter there, and one was after I became a reporter there. The first declaration, which was, I think, genius, I cannot see a 24-hour sports network making it in the United States.
Oh, good.
This was followed up by, who needs a camera in their phone? Two of my big predictions, maybe not the brightest. Don't go to me for stock advice. All right, we got just enough time for one more question.
All right,
give it to us.
All right, we'll start with me. What has been more influential in your life, your successes or your failures? I would say... For me, I mean, let's just, if I could narrow down and not life, but just down to maybe profession, I would say that normally I would augur toward failures. I think I learned a lot from those. I would say successes on one particular story that I wrote that was, I got a hold of it in a manner that actually, I think, elevated everything I did as a news writer because I finally figured out what it felt like to be good at something. When I finally got this story right, it completely, I still remember the way it felt. And it's a long story to get into it, but I actually got it to a place that I felt like, and I got attention from New York Times on down. Reporters were saying like, that the first time in my life that I actually felt like, all right, I'm finally a professional at this. And it then, of course, didn't happen again. But for that moment, it was pretty special. Frank?
I would have to say failures because... When I look at my life and I think of I have a very happy marriage with a wonderful person, but I went through a lot of failed relationships to get to that point, and each one was a learning experience. And so, yeah, the failures definitely influenced the success, big time.
Okay.
Failures, 100%. I wouldn't call it failures. I would say more adversity has driven all my influences and all the directions that I've turned. Dealing with my learning disabilities, having other, you know, issues that we all kind of experience at home with family and other stuff. So I know that all the failures have always put me in the position to actually achieve and come out better. So it's always about the failures and adversities.
All right, then. All right, though, folks, thanks again for joining us with The Robot. The Robot didn't embarrass us too much today, although it certainly did try. Coming up in the next hour, we are going to be talking to Stacey Jo Rust. We're going to talk about how Major League Baseball wants to get to second base. It's not as actually exciting as it sounds. And what else? The Dolphins. That's coming up for the Seahawks right after the break.